yet. And this is a message, and a very important and integral part of the message of Islam and all of the message of all of the prophets. For example, when Hazrat Ibrahim alayhi salam, the Prophet Abraham alayhi salam, was arguing with the polytheists, in Surah An'am, verse 76 to 78, it relates the following from him. From Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, فَلَمَّا جَنَّ عَلَيْهِ اللَّيْلِ رَأَى كَوْكَبًا قَالَ هَذَا رَبِّي. The Prophet Abraham was arguing with his people. He saw a star. The people of the time of Abraham would worship these astronomical bodies, the stars, the moon, the sun, and these kind of things. Because of the same reason, they thought that these were the beings whose responsibility it was to regulate the affairs of the universe. The Prophet Abraham, all right, he argues with them by saying that these astronomical bodies, they are subject to decay, they're subject to destruction, they set, they rise, they're subject to motion. If the regulation of the affairs of the universe was in the hands of these beings, such beings, the universe would be destroyed. It wouldn't last, just like these bodies don't last. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the problem of the unity of God's Lordship. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Round the World with Reporters.
As thousands of people continue to die each and every day in the EU from COVID-19, a great deal of focus is on the issue of vaccines. The subject has just been debated by EU lawmakers.
Le campagne vaccinali sono
Inoculation campaigns began in the UK, the US, Russia and China. The European Union, what was it doing? It's been behind schedule again, waiting for some sort of green light from the European Medicines Agency. Same thing with managing the pandemic. The EU worked very badly. Nations had to go it alone.
We are told that the European Medicines Agency, which authorizes vaccines on behalf of the 27-nation EU, will give the go-ahead next week for use of the Pfizer-BioNTech jab. The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has tweeted that vaccination will start across the EU on December 27th, 28th and 29th. However, there is concern that nations are not prepared. Apparently, many EU countries have not yet submitted their vaccination plans to the Commission. EU authorities insist the process cannot be rushed.
Safety of vaccines.
We have been speaking to citizens.
We have to take care of getting this herd immunity through the vaccine. So it is key for our Western states to get there now, given that we're almost in the third wave, I think.
I just think that I will not get the vaccines for myself too early. I just want to wait a little bit to see if there are the secondary effects, bad effects on people.
Lawmakers are expressing outrage that the European Commission is resisting calls to share the formula of proven vaccines with developing nations on the basis that it would stifle investment into vaccine research.
I urge the Commission to rethink their position and to show the world that saving lives is more important than saving an outdated model of intellectual property rights. Access to medicine for all is a human right.
On the economic front, all sides agree that developing a successful vaccine strategy is crucial to preventing the EU from being rendered completely bankrupt. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
House of Kabul is a small but cozy coffee shop in downtown Tehran. As its name suggests, it's owned and operated by Afghan migrants. The cafe hosted reporters along with officials from the Iranian High Council for Human Rights for a friendly gathering to mark the International Migrants Day. It was a chance to both have a cup of tasty Afghan tea called Ghaymag and talk about the issues facing Afghan refugees in Iran.
What I came with my family to Iran 13 years ago and studied hospitality management here. I didn't face serious problems during my study in Iran, but now that I want to start a business, I have to go through a complicated process to acquire the needed licenses.
This was also the case for the owner of the House of Kabul Cafe, who moved to Iran 35 years ago and studied fine arts, and then ran this cafe as a family business. His son, Ali Akbar, who works as a barista here, says it was not an easy job to launch this coffee shop.
It took my father several years to get the license to run this cafe. It was because none of our family members have related degrees. But I'm so happy that we finally launched it, and we have many customers who enjoy our Afghan traditional drinks and foods.
More than 3 million Afghans live in Iran. Around 1 million of them are refugees who have fled the ongoing conflict driven by terrorism and the presence of foreign troops in their country. Together with some 3,000 Iraqi refugees, they made Iran the 8th largest refugee hosting country in the world in 2019. The head of Iran's High Council for Human Rights did not ignore the issues migrants face in Iran and said he was here to listen to their concerns.
A significant portion of the Afghan refugees in Iran have entered the country illegally, and this creates some problems, especially with regards to their children's education. But during the past years and following a decree issued by our leader, all Afghan immigrants have access to free education. Today, our Afghan brothers and sisters in Iran are active in a variety of fields, and today I had the chance to speak to some of their elites and listen to their concerns.
Based on the United Nations 2019 estimates, there are around 272 million migrants in the world. That's 3.5% of the global population. Each year on December 18th, the International Migrants Day is marked to highlight the contributions made by the migrant communities and to address the challenges they face. This year, the occasion focuses on the issue of social cohesion as one of the major concerns of each migrant.
Afghan migrants here say dignity and respect are the main things each migrant needs to integrate into a new society. This gains even more significance when they try to restart their lives in a place other than their home country, where they seek to build new lives away from conflict and disaster. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A new report says at least 40 European Parliament lawmakers from 14 member states signed a petition demanding that products from Israeli settlements be banned by the bloc. According to Palestine Embassy in Brussels, the petition calls for the application of European law and World Trade Organization law to prevent Israeli settlements' products from entering into the EU's markets. BDS, anti-Israel movement promoting boycotts, divestments, and sanctions against Israel, praised the move and hoped for further measures against the occupying regime.
It's an important move in the right direction. We have repeatedly demanded the European Parliament to ban goods from Israeli settlements because of crimes committed by the Israeli regime.
Many European Union nations decided to only label imported Israeli products that are produced in settlements in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and in the Golan Heights. Palestinian experts say barring goods produced in illegal settlements from entering into the EU markets will serve as a heavy blow to Israel, mainly because settlement goods are exported directly to European markets.
This reflects the European public opinion's main stance on the Palestinian cause. The petition is now going through its legal stages in the European Parliament. We hope it could be approved as a law in the future.
The cutting of Israeli products around the world has been growing rapidly in recent years and caused heavy losses to Israeli companies. Thousands of volunteers, trade unions, NGOs, academic and business societies, as well as cultural figures worldwide, have joined the boycott campaign to help promote the Palestinian cause. Most European countries don't deal with settlement products in the same way as Israeli products. They don't label them as being produced in Israel. But the most important for the Palestinians would be when the EU prohibits import and sale of goods, services, and natural resources originating from illegal Israeli settlements. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
The Afghan Taliban delegation is in Pakistan to discuss the peace efforts. The delegation is headed by Mullah Brother, the head of Taliban's political office in Doha. The visit comes after Taliban and Afghan government took a 20-day break in their talks taking place in Doha. After months of negotiations, the two sides recently agreed on the rules of engagement. But there is no progress on the comprehensive ceasefire as Taliban have linked the truce with peace deal. But the Pakistan's foreign minister, who also met the Taliban leaders, said Taliban have shown their readiness to seek an end to the war. Afghan Taliban and the US signed a landmark deal in February this year. The deal outlines a roadmap for the US troops withdrawal from Afghanistan. In return, Taliban agreed not to allow Afghan soil to be used again by terrorist groups. Given Pakistan's historic ties with the Taliban, the US and Afghan government expect Islamabad to ensure that the Taliban live up to their commitment. At the moment, all eyes are on the incoming US president as to whether he will follow the same policy on Afghanistan or take a different course. On paper, there seems no change in the policy of US President-elect Joe Biden with regard to Afghanistan. But he may not hasten the troops withdrawal as sought by President Trump. This means the situation in Afghanistan will remain uncertain, at least in the foreseeable future. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
In recent years, the U.S. Federal Reserve has reported multiple times that 40% of Americans don't have the cash to cover just a $400 emergency. Then COVID hit. The lack of savings is now almost twice as bad. A recent poll by the Highland Consultancy reveals that a stunning 82% of Americans now don't have the savings for a $500 emergency. It's a shocking reminder that the wealth in the richest nation in the world is distributed in a shockingly unequal fashion. For the average American household, $500 is equal to half a month's housing costs, 3 weeks of transportation, 2 weeks of child care for one child, and less than a month of food.
If human needs are met, then people can put money away for emergencies. But when you're living where you can barely feed yourself, and where you can barely meet your housing needs, how can you possibly put money away?
In the decentralized United States, uneven, often draconian lockdowns are entering their ninth month, but there hasn't been any government help since a federal package in March. The result is a bevy of simply atrocious data, which reveals the financial suffering of the average American. 63% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck since the pandemic began. Public sector wages recently had their biggest monthly drop ever. New weekly jobless claims were greater than the worst week of the Great Recession for the 39th straight week. 800 small businesses have closed every day nationwide since April. Clearly, America's Main Street was already teetering on the edge prior to Corona.
We've got a society that's structured towards not meeting basic needs. That's important to everybody in the economy, that it have a sound foundation. And if you have people who are desperate on your foundation, the economy is always in danger of collapsing.
Corona deaths keep rising, the economy keeps plummeting, except for rich assets like stocks. And it's still not certain who won the presidential election. The U.S. is in the middle of its worst crisis since the 1930s, but it might be even worse than that. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said his country will no longer be affected dramatically by U.S. sanctions. He also accused the U.S. of imposing sanctions on Turkey to prevent it from becoming independent and developing its own defense sector. Erdogan's comments came after U.S. imposed sanctions on Turkey's defense industries and its chief.
This decision is a blatant assault on our nation's sovereign rights. This has been imposed for the first time against us, a NATO member. What kind of an alliance is this? Now we will work twice as hard to make our defense industry fully independent.
Turkey has always criticized the U.S. for its unilateral actions against other countries in the region, such as Iran.
This is not the first time that the U.S. imposes unnecessary sanctions on other countries. The sanctions come as a punitive act against any country trying to become independent. But I think that Turkey will overcome the sanctions.
Washington had already punished Ankara in July by barring it from developing parts for and acquiring America's next generation F-35 fighter jets. Earlier, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif condemned what he called U.S. addiction to sanctions and contempt for international law. The sanctions cut off Turkey's top defense procurement agency from U.S. financial institutions, military hardware, and technology. Ties between the two NATO allies, Turkey and the U.S., were strained last year due to Ankara's purchase of S-400 missiles from Russia. However, Turkey says it had to resort to Moscow to meet its needs after its own allies stopped responding to its demands. Reshan Saglam, Istanbul.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has stressed that the Islamic Republic will certainly take revenge for the U.S. assassination of the country's top general, Qasem Soleimani. Ayatollah Khamenei said Soleimani, who was killed in a U.S. drone strike in Iraq in January, has turned into a national hero for Iranians as well as Muslims elsewhere in the world. The leader said million-strong funerals that were held for the general served as a severe slap in the face of the Americans. He added that the expulsion of the U.S. troops from the region will be a more severe blow to the United States. Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader called on officials to explore ways to remove sanctions, but stressed that efforts should be focused on neutralizing the sanctions first. Ayatollah Khamenei cautioned against trusting the enemies and warned that America's hostilities towards Iran will not end even after President Donald Trump leaves office. The leader also lashed out at the European signatories to the Iran nuclear deal, saying they have showed utmost breach of commitments and hypocrisy. Also, President Hassan Rouhani said Iran is not overexcited that Joe Biden will replace Donald Trump in a matter of weeks.
Some people say you are rejoiced at the election of Mr. Biden. No, we are not, but we are very happy that Trump is leaving. A man who committed so many crimes, who was a murderer, a terrorist, a man who even is preventing us from buying coronavirus vaccines. This man has absolutely no morals. Yes, we are very happy that this tyrant, the one who was not committed to anything, is ousted.
Iranian officials have time and time again stressed that it does not matter who takes the helm at the White House as long as U.S. hostile policies towards Iran remain in place. Still, all eyes are now on the next U.S. administration to find out whether it will toe the line of its predecessors or reverse the course.
The Gaza Strip is witnessing a sharp increase in coronavirus infections, with thousands of cases being discovered on a daily basis. The Gaza Strip has logged more than 30,000 COVID-19 infections, mostly since late August. Hospitals in the blockaded enclave are running short on intensive care units to treat coronavirus patients. Experts say the Israeli blockade imposed on Gaza is the main reason why tackling the deadly pandemic is particularly difficult.
The blockade had devastated the Gaza Strip even before the coronavirus pandemic. Now our health sector suffers from acute shortage of medicines and hospital supplies. The health sector is falling apart, and the world must immediately intervene and help the Gaza Strip fight the coronavirus pandemic.
The coronavirus is fast spreading in the tiny enclave, and people fear the worst because of the high population density.
The health sector has been under pressure because of the blockade, and the coronavirus pandemic has only made things even worse. Over 200 people in Gaza have already died because of coronavirus.
The Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment, despite the alarming number of coronavirus infections.
We demand an immediate end to Israeli violations that amount to war crimes. We also hold Israel accountable for its illegal actions. Medicines and hospital supplies must be allowed to enter Gaza to help fight this deadly virus. The main obstacle to fight the coronavirus pandemic in Gaza is the Israeli blockade.
The United Nations has warned that the enclave's health system could collapse if the number of cases continues to rise. Gaza's health system has been battered by the Israeli blockade and three wars since 2007. The dire situation has worsened amid the coronavirus pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
An exhibition called Beyond the Columns of Media opened at the Museum of Classical Art based in Rome's La Sapienza University. The initiative, sponsored by the Italian ambassador to Tehran, Giuseppe Perrone, is the result of collaboration between the Italian Archaeological Mission in Iran and the Ministry of Cultural Heritage, Tourism and Handicrafts of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Iran's ambassador Hamid Bayat and La Sapienza University rector Antonella Polimeni were among the attendees of the event.
We decided to focus on the Kermanshah province from two points of view. One is that of sustainable tourism, and the other one, the study of cultural heritage. What we did here is travel the road that goes from Kasr Shirin to Kangavar and crosses ancient media.
The exhibit features 16 panels put together by Italian students, representing an ideal journey through the great ancient trade route and communication network known as the Silk Road.
It's very important because all these informations help us to understand better how the Sasanian period worked, how the region were connected.
Panels portrayed the historical region of the media between the Mesopotamian plain and the Iranian plateau. The exhibition itinerary follows a diachronic development that starts from the Iron Age through the dynasties of the Achaemenids, Arsacids, and Sassanids.
Italy and Iran have long-standing connections that go back in history and have resulted in a deep understanding between the two countries. The cultural and political relations date back to the time of the Roman and Persian empires and are marked by important affinities.
This project represents the full potential of collaboration between Italy's and Iran's cultural institutions. Its implementation makes us once again rediscover long-established Italian-Iranian connections.
Due to the COVID pandemic, most academic activities have been carried out remotely via video conference. All attendees wished for a prompt return to pre-COVID ways of working. Max Civili, Rome.
Britain woke up to more worrying news this December morning. 1,800, 19,000 fewer workers out of paid employment in November than at the start of the health crisis, meaning coronavirus continues to weigh heavily on the UK labour market.
Is this the direct impact of the pandemic on the UK's labour market?
The problem started before the coronavirus, and the measures being taken are only glossing over the realities. The system is fundamentally flawed. Rich-poor division has got more extreme. The type of jobs coming in are not the old secure, well-paid jobs. They're the insecure, low-paid, temporary jobs.
Released by the Office for National Statistics, the report also says there has been a record rise in redundancies in the 3 months to October, 370,000 of them. Worst hit, those in the hospitality sector, teetering during the pandemic. The government says its measures are necessary for beating the virus.
We've put a lot of work in over the past month. There's been enormous sacrifice on everyone's part, and we want to make sure that we continue suppressing the virus. The good news is that we've made improvements, whether it's in mass testing or early promising news on vaccines.
While the prospect of a functioning vaccine has injected some optimism into people's lives, experts say the next few months are likely to remain very challenging.
Do you think more people are going to be out of work in the coming months?
Yes. They will falsify the figures. And they do that by, they've done this for years and years. And they massage out of the figures people who are really unemployed.
Add to the mix the immediate impact of a no-deal Brexit, the UK leaving the European Union without a trade deal at the end of this month.
There's also the fact that the unemployment figures don't tell the whole story. There's always a lag in the data. And the government's job retention scheme, also known as the furlough scheme, is propping up the labor market. For now.
In November, the UK Chancellor warned the number of unemployed people in the country was expected to surge to 2.6 million by the middle of next year, and that may be a conservative figure. The fact is that COVID-19 is here to stay, and it'll be months, if not longer, for everyone to be vaccinated. The unforgiving equation is that the tighter the measures to protect lives, the more devastating the impact on livelihoods. Saeed Pariza, London.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to another episode from series of Q&A on Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. If you have been following this series of sessions and shows, we have been talking about different questions and misconceptions concerning some Islamic issues, and the respected guest speakers and guests of this show will try to provide us with some answers. Today, again, like always, we have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi, researcher from Qom Seminary Schools, to answer the questions that we pose in this very session. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation. Okay, Sheikh, the question of the day again is the same question that we asked in our last week's session. That is the domestic violence and the viewpoint of Islam concerning the domestic violence. You pinpointed some cases and some factors that might cause and lead to domestic violence from the viewpoint of Quran, and then you actually very beautifully answered and explained how Islam wants us as the servants of God and the duty-bound people how to lessen the amount of the domestic violence. At the end of the session, I think you continued with some advices that Islam tells to the Muslims how to behave in order to remove this domestic violence. I think some of the points have been left uncovered. I want you to first wrap that story up, inshallah, and then after that we shall ask some other questions.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, we said that Islam has some instructions for people to reduce the domestic violence. One of them was controlling one's anger, and the other one, which is more applicable when it comes to wives and husbands, was the fact that Islam tries to instruct, especially the men, the proper relationship between men and women.
True.
Let me refer to the famous story of Sa'd ibn Mu'adh to, let the dear listeners know about the importance of this issue. We know that Sa'd ibn Mu'adh, one of the greatest companions of the Prophet, he was one of the Ansar, one of the leaders of Ansar. He helped the Prophet a lot. And the Holy Prophet, in his when he passed away, the Holy Prophet did very extraordinary action in his funeral ceremony, like walking barefoot and putting the corpse in the grave himself, and so on and so forth. So it shows how great Sa'd ibn Mu'adh was in the eyes of the Prophet. When he was buried, his mother, knowing her son and seeing all these actions by the Prophet, addressing her son, she said that, glad tidings for you, my dear sons, because of the fact that now you are in heaven, you are in paradise. But then the Holy Prophet told her that this is not the case. Now he that is Sa'd ibn Mu'adh, is punished in the grave, the pressure of the grave, which is one of the punishments in the world of Barzakh. And people were surprised and asked about the reason. The Holy Prophet said that although he was, of course, I'm paraphrasing, although he was a great man, although he was in the service of Islam, he helped the cause of Islam a lot. But because of the fact that he was bad-tempered regarding his wife and his family members, now he is punished. Mm-hmm. So this is how great is the, importance of proper relationship between men and women in Islam.
So, Sheikh, I want to take a permission and ask a question here. Usually Islam is being introduced to others through its followers and also from the sources. For a person who is not inside the circle of Islam might ask that he was the closest companion to the Prophet and he was actually the person of taking at least domestic violence at home. That's in case he actually goes with some of the...
Of course, I did not mention the domestic violence. He was only bad-tempered. I wanted to say that he was bad-tempered.
Domestic violence,
and
if he's not necessarily beating somebody at home,
if you want
it can be through tongue and the words that one might use, in case we define it in this way.
Yeah.
And the other case that a person might also think of Islam is that the text, the famous text, is very holy to us and needs to be interpreted. The Holy Quran, in some verses, tells us that, for example, the man can beat the ladies, the women. So how can we actually collect between these information? How can we need to interpret these words for those who are not familiar with the literature of Quran? Definitely it does not necessarily mean to go and take, for example, a weapon, wheat, and beat your women and ladies. So it is really not what is being taken from the surface of the verse itself. So if you shed some light on these issues, we'd be thankful, Sheikh.
Yes, sure. There is a very famous verse in the Noble Book of Quran. Many people mentioned this verse, and they have concluded that Islam is a religion supporting domestic violence, because they think that, according to Islam, men are free to beat their women whenever they wish. Before reciting the verse, let me just share some narrations to give us a picture about how Islam views, physical punishment of women by men, how Islam views beating women.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember, I said in the previous program that according to a prophetic narration, woman is Rayhana, is a good-smelling flower.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Islam is seriously against, beating women.
Yeah.
And physical punishment of women by men. Let me just share some narrations. It gives us a picture, then we'll discuss the verse.
Mm-hmm.
In one narration, the Holy Prophet says, the worst of you, that is the men, is the one who beats his wife. The worst of the men, mm-hmm, is the one who beats his wife. In another narration, this is very interesting narration, the Holy Prophet says that I'm surprised by seeing a man who beats his wife while he himself deserves more to be beaten.
Mm-hmm.
In many narrations, the women are prohibited from beating the women, and it is mentioned in the narrations and it is mentioned in Islamic jurisprudence that it brings about the verdict of qisas or retaliation. When women are beaten, they have the right to go to an Islamic court and then ask for retaliation. In one narration, again, we are told that if a man slaps his wife on her face, On the day of judgment, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala orders the angel, who is the guardian of the hellfire, to slap this man 70 times on his face in the hellfire. And also it is mentioned that if you pull your wife with your wife's hair with your hands, then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will punish you on the day of judgment by hitting nails into your hands. And also the Holy Prophet says that, is it proper for some of you to beat your wife and then hug him after that? So I think all these narrations, again, when it comes to jurisprudence, we are told that no man has the right to beat his wife to the extent that the skin becomes red, let alone wounding her, let alone when the skin becomes black. So there are many other narrations. I think this much is enough to give us a picture out of how Islam views physical punishment of women by men. But having said that, again, people refer to that famous narration, to that famous verse in chapter An-Nisa, verse 34. We have to take into consideration the whole verse and the context, and then explain about the word wazribuhunna, which many people think that it is referring to a kind of freedom for men to beat their wives. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم واللاتي تخافون نشوزهن فعزوهن واهجروهن في المضاجع واضربوهن فإن أطعنكم فلا تبغوا عليهن سبيلا. So in this verse we have the concept of nushuz, which some people translated as desertion or rebellion or ill conduct. So according to this verse, let me read the translation. As to those women on whose part you fear desertion or ill conduct, first of all, admonish them, فَعِذُهُنَّ, then refuse to share their beds, and last, beat them, وَضْرِبُهُنْ. But if they return to obedience, seek not against their means of annoyance anymore, for Allah is the Most High, the Great, above you all. So in this verse we have the concept of nushuz or desertion or ill conduct or rebellion. Now the point is that Islam says that in the family, when the men are against women, when the men are not doing their responsibilities and their duties, because of the fact that normally women are not able to seek their rights themselves, Islam encourages women to go to Islamic and Muslim authorities to seek for their rights. So if a man is rebellious in the house, if a man is not acting upon his responsibilities, it is mentioned in Islamic jurisprudence that it is the right for women to go, at the time of the Prophet, we have many examples, to go to the Prophet, to go to the Imam, or now to go to an Islamic court and complain about and against her husband, and the court will give her all her rights.
Okay.
But when it comes to a lady being rebellious inside the house, she is not ready to act upon her responsibilities, especially when it comes to satisfying the sexual desires of her husband. According to Islam, to some extent, I repeat and put emphasis on this fact, that to some extent, men have been given this right to somehow fix the situation themselves. Because of the fact that, according to Islam, and according to, even the science, men, when it comes to power, they are more powerful, and in some cases, they are able to fix it. But how? This is very important. So, addressing the men, Islam says that if your women are rebellious, if they are not, acting upon your commands, of course, the legal commands. We are not talking about any order of the husband. No, we're talking about the legal orders of the husband. Mm-hmm. First of all, the first step. So Islam says that there are three steps, and they are, they are not horizontal. They should be taken one after the other. The first is فَعِذُهُنَّ, you have to admonish them. So in many cases, it might happen that a man is not able to admonish a woman the way he needs to do so. So in that case, he has no right to go to the second and the third steps. He should ask others to do so. He should maybe in that case go to a court.
Yeah.
This is very important. Some people ignore this fact. So the first step is to admonish women. Either by the man himself, if he has all the qualifications to do so, or else he needs to go to qualified people.
And if admonishing does not work?
Yeah. And the next step is to be away from the bed. Sometimes when the men ignore their women, when it comes to, sexual desires, it might be a solution for the rebellious women to, come back and to her duties and act upon her duties. And the last one is wadribuhunna, which is translated by most of the translators as beating the women. So when it comes to this word, we have 2 points. First of all, there are some scholars who believe that wadribuhunna in this verse does not mean beating at all. It means leaving the women. There is at least this possibility. I will explain about that. And second of all, if it translated as to beating, there are many conditions which tell us that the way beating should be applied is very, very light, to the extent that in today's terms and standards, we cannot call it a beating, because it is mentioned in the narrations that you can do it with a very, very, very thin stick, like what they call it, the sewak stick, to the extent that it doesn't lead even the skin to be red. So very in true. Today's terminology, we cannot call it beating.
So this verse needs to be interpreted in the right way that it has been already actually interpreted.
Yes.
Thank you very much, and hopefully, inshallah, we shall finalize this discussion in our upcoming session. Dear brothers and sisters, may thanks for staying tuned, and I'd like to invite you to join us again in our next session. Till then, I'll leave in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Ali وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
On the same day the first American received a coronavirus vaccine, the U.S. pandemic death toll surpassed 300,000 on Monday, December 14th, another grim milestone that comes less than 4 weeks after the number of COVID-19 deaths in the country reached 250,000. Despite constituting just over 4% of the global population, the United States of America is home to nearly 19% of more than 1.6 million COVID-19 deaths that have occurred worldwide. The disproportionate impact of the pandemic on the American population was called a catastrophic failure of leadership to be blamed on President Donald Trump, who baselessly claimed in February that the virus was on the verge of disappearing. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kenny Stancil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "It Never Had to Be Like This. 300,000 Dead in U.S. from COVID-19 under Donald J. Trump." Here is the details of this article. On the same day the first American received the coronavirus vaccine, the U.S. pandemic death toll surpassed 300,000 on Monday, December 14th, another grim milestone that comes less than 4 weeks after the number of COVID-19 deaths in the country reached 250,000. The Associated Press put the staggering statistics into context. The number of dead rivals the population of St. Louis or Pittsburgh. It is equivalent to repeating a tragedy on the scale of Hurricane Katrina every day for 5 1-second months. It is more than five times the number of Americans killed in the Vietnam War. It is equal to 9/11 attack every day for more than 100 days. At the same time, Brian Walter, who lost his 80-year-old father to the disease, told NPR that the numbers do not reflect that these were people. Everyone lost was a father or a mother. They had kids. They had family. They left people behind. According to the COVID-19 tracking project, the U.S. is now averaging nearly 2,430 deaths per day. Jennifer Nazo, a public health researcher at Johns Hopkins University, told AP that to think now we can just absorb in our country 3,000 deaths a day as though it were just business as usual, it just represents a moral failing. Despite constituting just over 4% of the global population, the United States of America is home to nearly 19% of more than 1.6 million COVID-19 deaths that have occurred worldwide. The disproportionate impact of the pandemic on the American population was called a catastrophic failure of leadership to be blamed on President Donald Trump, who baselessly claimed in February that the virus was on the verge of disappearing. There is no need for that many to have died, David Hayes Bautista, a professor of medicine at the University of California, Los Angeles, told the New York Times. We chose as a country to take our foot off the gas pedal. We chose to, and that's the tragedy. As Common Dreams reported earlier this month, progressives have argued that the catastrophic handling of the coronavirus crisis in the U.S., while made worse by Trump and non-cooperative individuals, is better understood as the product of several decades of free market ideology and associated policies that exacerbated inequalities and hampered an effective governmental response to the disaster as it unfolded. Although Monday, December 14th, coronavirus vaccine rollout represents good news in the fight against the pandemic, physician and public health experts Ashia Jahar Brown University lamented that the worst is yet to come in the United States of America regarding the coronavirus pandemic, as a result of infections that have already happened or will this week, we will pass 400,000 deaths in January, he said. He also added that vaccines will help, but if we are serious about meeting the challenge of preventing the COVID-19 death toll from reaching 500,000, we can and must do more to stop the spread of the coronavirus. Actions taken collectively can really change the course of what is happening, Nicholas Reich, a biostatistician at the University of Massachusetts, told The Times. He added, one reason this is hard to predict is, to some extent, the power is in our hands.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, Scientific Laws and Resurrection. It is remarkable that science, with its modern discoveries, has taken a long step forward towards proving the possibility of resurrection and life after here. And with the enunciation of the doctrine of the imperishability of matter and energy, the resurrection, which previously appeared to be impossible, has now become logical and comprehensible. I know it's a heavy dose, but this is a concept that, if you understand, many of your issues and many of your confusions can be resolved. science today has actually, through its imperishability of matter and energy, has concluded something that we could not accept in the past. You know, general human beings could not accept logically in the past. The doctrine of imperishability of matter, which was first discovered by Lavoisier, has rendered the question of complete annihilation totally unscientific. In other words, you know, a human body and human being, the existence of human, cannot be completely annihilated. And he says that it's totally unscientific. According to his theory, the particles of man, however decomposed and scattered they may become, still exist in this very world. And it is impossible that one day they are recollected. This is the first step forward towards the possibility of the resurrection of man and his return to life after death. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are talking about scientific laws and resurrection. And we explain for you the imperishability of matter and energy. In the first part, we talked about imperishability of matter. Now let's look into energy. Well, this doctrine was further reinforced by the discovery of radioactive bodies of Marie Curie. Her discovery confirmed that not only matter, but energy is also everlasting, and that there is no duality between matter and energy, for they are convertible with each other. Those who have a science background, they know exactly what I'm saying. On this basis, we should admit that our ideas, our deeds, and all our movements, which are all produced by the transformation of various bodily energies, continue to exist in this world. Our vocal waves are not obliterated, and their traces always exist in the air and the objects which surround us. Only their form is changed, okay? The same is the case with all works and deeds. This is another step towards the possibility of resurrection and even physically seeing the deeds themselves. Anyhow, with the progress of science, the question of resurrection is no longer as complicated as it was once. Now it is comprehensible and, from a scientific standpoint, fully admissible. Science has no choice but to accept that matter and energy cannot just completely annihilate. They change forms, but they cannot go away for good. Once in existence, they stay in existence in one form and shape or the other. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.